We talk a lot about using AI at startups, but what are the more established companies doing to scale AI prototyping internally?
With AI, it's a lot more about like, okay, how do we document this so that it's available in the AI and the LLM's memory at all times? As opposed to typically with the design system, the way I see that we would do these things is through programs and people and cultural reinforcement, design reviews, that sort of stuff. Now it's like, okay, can we just tell it exactly what we care about?
How do you use your design system to get the most out of tools like Replit or Figma Make?
Now we're kind of going into a fluid model where anyone with any tool can essentially ship to a customer. And we need to figure out how to support that. Like, the design system remit has just blown up into like anyone in the organization can essentially ship. And that's a really challenging problem to solve.
Welcome to Dive Club. My name is Rid, and this is where designers never stop learning. This week's episode is with Lewis Healy and Kyler Hall, and they're doing a deep dive into all of the ways that they scaled AI prototyping at Atlassian. And I want to start this conversation by taking a look at how they're using templates in Figma Make, because I've never seen this approach before.
With AI prototyping, at the beginning, it very much was about just like allowing people to spin up or ideate ideas with code. So very much like, how do we augment product managers, product designers, content designers to essentially create a coded prototype of their idea. Initially, when we were kind of piloting AI prototyping earlier this year, design system team wasn't necessarily the key integration for AI prototyping. It was very much like, oh, let's just focus on low fidelity and just spin something up. Mm-hmm. And very quickly, once we gave people access to these AI prototyping tools, it very much was like, well, I need this to look like an Atlassian experience. How do we do that? And that's when the kind of design system team came in and we kind of created what you're seeing here, these templates. So this template essentially is that starting point, that kind of baseline for people to spin up a experience. So whether they want to create their own kind of like sub template. So we have a lot of apps in our collections at Atlassian. So we have Jira, Confluence, Loom. They may want to create their own specific template for product designers to use and kind of experiment, ideate on. And, you know, they don't want to have to create a roadmap every single time. But to do that, they want to essentially get some very similar content, which is, like, you know, the top nav and the side nav. They kind of need to be the same or very high fidelity. So we've realized that if we create this kind of base template, then you get these things like the top nav and the side nav consistent, but then also allows them to then make their own version. We've landed on this like kind of abstracted template where it's not actually a specific product. It's just a bunch of elements that the AI would usually get quite wrong. So our top nav and our side nav was very, very hard to consistently generate. What we would find is when we were kind of initially creating these instructions to generate these prototypes, it would hallucinate the icons, the navigation elements. Like our navigation system has a lot of imports and it would just always get one or two wrong. You know, if people were uploading a screenshot and trying to kind of replicate an experience in production, the top nav and the side nav would also be incredibly wrong because we're in a kind of state of improving the visual refresh of it. This is why this template was born, where we're like, okay, let's just code the top nav. Let's just code the side nav. And then when people are uploading a screenshot of the side navigation elements that they want, that we found the agent, you know, Figma Make and Replit is actually very, very good at just changing the code that already exists. When before, when we were focusing on our instructions, it was taking nothing and trying to build everything. So we found just that kind of that initial starting point reduced probably the error rate from maybe like half of the prototypes were having a lot of navigation issues to probably nearly zero of them. Maybe just a few icon hallucinations here and there. But if you upload a screenshot of any side navigation in Atlassian, it's going to get a lot of the combination of navigation elements pretty correct. And that really supercharged prototyping for people. Because what we found is people were spending like maybe 2 or 3 hours just trying to get that top nav and side navigation pixel perfect, because that's what makes you feel like you're in an Atlassian experience. And when you're testing with customers, you want the top nav and side nav or the Chrome to feel like you're in an Atlassian product. Otherwise, people are going to get too distracted. But the content, it's not that important. What we found is if you kind of do any content or any main content in this area, you can kind of get away with it. But when the top navigation and the side navigation is incorrect, people start to get a little bit confused, the wayfinding's a little bit off. So we've really solved that by having that hybrid approach of like a pre-coded template with design system instructions. So then when you're building on top of it and when you're creating more product specific templates like a roadmap, etc., it's not going to get the basic elements and incorrect.
Real quick message and then we can jump back into it. So I got a new computer recently, and what do you think was the very first app that I installed? If you've been listening to this show for a bit, then you probably guessed that the answer is Raycast. And at this point, it is an extension of my fingertips and a fundamental way that I use my computer. And I'm not alone. I mean, I see this sentiment from people I looked up to on Twitter all the time. So if you're still on the fence, I mean, just do it. Download Raycast and thank me later. Just head to dive.club/Raycast to get started. All right, here's the thing. You don't need another dashboard. What you need to do is to talk to customers. So I want to introduce you to Genway AI. You can think of it kind of like vibe researching to validate your ideas quickly. Just draft your questions, select an ICP, and then their AI agent runs interviews on your behalf by pulling from a panel of global participants. I mean, you could literally set it up in the morning and get actionable insights by lunchtime. It's validation at your fingertips, and you can try it out free for 14 days. Just head to dive.club/Genway to get started. That's Genway. Okay, now onto the episode. It's genius because I've spent so much time just making little tweaks to the shell of my UI when actually the only thing that I want to prototype is a piece of the content, or maybe it's a different layout on the screen. And I don't care about the sidebar. I just want it to feel a little bit real. I mean, I've got so frustrated with it that at times I've even taken screenshots of prod and my first prompt is add this image as the background to the page. And then I just put components on top of it because I'm tired of adjusting the shell. And so this starting point makes a lot of sense. I'm even just going to restate my understanding. So for myself and everybody, it's like really clear how this is being used. So we're looking at Figma Make. This is presumably a file in a project somewhere that anybody can just run and duplicate. And it exists in code. It's not any one real product. It's honestly kind of just a set of like core scaffolding and subcomponents and sidebar interactions that the AI is then using as a foundation to build whatever that person wants. And then you've even baked some education for how to use the template into like the core page layout itself. And so anybody can open this up and they just start typing and talking with the agent about what they want to make. Is that kind of correct understanding?
Absolutely. Yeah. So this template, you can either use it where you're creating your own sub templates. So, you know, that kind of Jira specific roadmap that then people then want to then duplicate. So it's a bit of a network effect. Or you can just, if you're creating an entirely new experience, you're just ideating something new, you just duplicate this template and then you can just, you know, go for your life. So we've included some, you know, key instructions to people. You know, if you want to change the product name to Jira, what we've actually tried to do is we found that hallucinations of this icon and this logo were very, very common. There's a huge spectrum of confidence and understanding of how to prompt at Atlassian. And what we found, some people were saying, like, change logo to Jira. And what it would do is it would go based on its pre-trained knowledge, and it would just pull in a really old Jira logo and then swap that out. So what we've actually found is by having a configuration object of just some hard, you know, constants that then includes product icon and some elements, and then hooking that up to the top navigation component, randomly, we found that actually it hallucinated a lot less. And then on top of that, we found it hallucinated even less when we gave people like a copyable command that rather than saying change logo to Jira, they can just click that and copy it. And then they know how to switch things into that logo. So we've kind of had this really hybrid approach of like pre-coded elements, you know, design system instructions, but then also the user experience of how to reduce very common and like annoying hallucinations that were just, you know, create that extra one or two prompts, but it would probably really lower the bar of people's confidence that they can't seem to get the simplest stuff working. And that's because, you know, the AI doesn't know about the intricacies of these new logos we've created. It's just going based off what it has been, you know, pre-trained on, which is like, oh, this is the Jira logo. So we found that really, really effective.
Before this, we just tried to give people a set of prompts, like here's 100 lines, copy and paste this into Figma Make. It might work. It might set it up. And a lot of that's like, we have a bunch of theming. We have like feature flags and feature gates that have to be turned on that aren't even documented well outside of internally. So it's very hard to ask an LM to do that. The only way to really do it is basically have an engineer tell you how to do it. So we want prototypes to kind of show off where we're headed. We might use them for demos and design reviews, that sort of stuff. So we of course want it to ideally be cutting edge and possibly even you know, future baked. So a lot of that just requires us to kind of bake in a lot of the code things that a designer should never even know exist. We started with those prompts and a lot more of them. And then over time, it's just like, well, what if we just bake the entire default that an engineer should know by heart into these templates, so people could just iterate very quickly.
We're also taking that a little bit further as well, where you may not want an entire template, right? Like we have, you know, Rovo, which is our kind of, you know, AI and Atlassian, and that's kind of interfaced through a chat box. Now, do you have to duplicate a template to just add Rovo in? Probably not, right? Like if you already have an existing prototype, it gets a little bit cumbersome. So what we've found is we've created this thing called recipes, where they are kind of what Carlo mentioned before, which is like a code blob with some instructions, basically, of like, here's how you recreate the chat box, and then this is where you put it. And it's not going to be pixel perfect to what is in production, but it's going to be good enough to get that look and feel without having to make every single user of prototyping upload a screenshot and try and get that pixel perfect. So we found this kind of recipe approach as well really helps with those like smaller elements that, you know, are maybe a little bit more technical for people to do. Another example is like dark mode by default. Some of our user personas are that, you know, developers probably aren't using light mode by default. And if we're prototyping, maybe we want dark mode. That's, you know, involving a lot of like theming coding. It's a little bit tricky to actually change the default mode to dark mode. So we created a recipe where you can just paste a bunch of instructions in and it will just switch out the mode for you into dark mode. So we're trying to think of the user experience of a non-technical user using code, which can be a challenge in itself.
Okay, so this is the end state. It's beautiful. You're introducing me to a lot of concepts that I haven't considered before. Even the way that you're thinking about recipes is genius. I think my goal after seeing this now is to kind of understand, like, how can someone else reverse engineer this system that you've built? Because I'm pretty sold. So can we even go back in time a bit and talk about, like, what did it take to even arrive at that end state? And maybe we can dig into some of the lessons that you've learned along the way.
Essentially, how we started to integrate the design system is, you know, Carla and I thought, oh, great, sweet. We're just going to take our Atlassian documentation. We're going to put in a bunch of examples or a text file, upload that text file and say, now build with this. And we got some pretty rubbish results because, first of all, the file was massive. So it was just truncating the information and only creating a subset of the components. But it also didn't really know how to use those components and how to use it in an AI prototyping world. Because what we were doing is we were applying just the mental model of a human using documentation and trying to apply it to a machine or an AI. So that was a very, very quick learning of, yeah, okay, that's not going to work. Let's actually just like figure out how to actually talk to this machine. And I think some of the cool things that we did is we got some really good results by actually trying to talk to the AI in a way that it understands. What I mean by that is that we have a guidelines.md file, which includes all of our design system documentation. Now, eventually this will be an MCP once we can plug in MCP, but for now, these are instruction files. And this is essentially how we get design system generations to a pretty high fidelity. But there's an interesting thing that we found really valuable, which I've not seen too many people do, which is we try and instruct it to kind of think in Tailwind still, which is obviously gonna, it's pre-trained data. I assume most models have been trained on ShadCN and Tailwind because of the amount of open source code out there, which is, you know, why everything is React as well. We try and go, okay, generate that. When you think in Tailwind classes, once you see this thing, it's actually this design system component. So what we mean by that is we actually have in every instruction, in every one of our components, we have a translating from Tailwind section where we say, if you see these class names, actually it should be this React code. And we found this actually really beneficial in terms of reducing some of those hallucinations where, you know, we have a component in Atlassian called Lozenge. Now, I don't think I've seen Lozenge in many other design systems. It's a very specific name. And then whenever there's new people joining Atlassian, they're like, what's a Lozenge? And then we have to explain it. So AI is probably not going to know what a Lozenge is. It's probably going to think it's something else. This provides an opportunity for us to kind of say, oh, you see it this way. Feel free to think that way, but then now translate it into something that we want to generate. So you can see here, like span, if it's, you know, using these Tailwind classes, it's actually this important badge. And we found that really effective in reducing quite a lot of hallucinations. And at the top, we then have really specific instructions saying, you know, use the Atlassian design system first, use design tokens first, and then use Tailwind for like kind of missing things and try and swap things over.
Who's responsible for this document? I mean, this is about as robust as a guidelines document I've ever seen.
Myself and Kyla. The first version of this was fully vibe coded. So Kyla was away for a month, I think, in Japan. And I love working with Kyla. And I was just in this depth of like having to get this design system integration working because we were in the middle of a pilot and we had 300 people wanting to just like use design system. And I had no way of understanding how to do that. So the first set of these instructions was absolutely vibe coded. And I'm sure Kyla can attest to it. Like there was a lot of discrepancies. There was a lot of like just contradictions and everything, but it got really good results. Then after that, we then decided, okay, how do we actually centrally manage this? And how do we actually generate this with some level of consistency, which I'm sure Carlo can talk about how we got to that now.
So on Atlassian Design, we have an LM's full file, and that's about 5,000 lines of just agente content. And we'll say 90% of that was vibe coded about 9 months ago, because it was like, oh, okay, let's actually, you know, I think the journey for a lot of us was like, oh, hey, we can use Cursor. Like it's allowed to use Cursor. We also got VS Code and like different things click for different people at different times. I think I clicked with Cursor and I was like, okay, what does it look like to teach it how to work with the design system? And a lot of that was just like, okay, let me just create instructions to tell it how to use our token system because it does not get it from its industry training model at all. So we just have to basically make a table of here's every single token. So this is like the first version that we, I would say we started with, I think back in like March. Well, this has probably come a long ways from the first version, but this is the current iteration of the first version, which we were like, okay, what does it look like just to put all of this agentic content? Like there's a bunch of prompts floating around, which is like, hey, how do you create a button? How do you style something? How do you use our tokens? How do you use our theming? That sort of stuff that was floating around for probably a month. And it was like, okay, can we just make this public? So we made an LMS.txt file. The full version is kind of all of our content truncated together. And yeah, kind of a lot of it was just, let's create some maps to explain like what these things mean. And then over in Figma Make and Replit, we've actually, in addition to showing light and dark modes, we'll actually show like a Tailwind class as well, just for context. I don't have that up. But yeah, this is really where it started, but this is like 5,000 lines, whereas we've kind of settled on something more 2,000 to 3,000 lines within prototyping that's a little bit more succinct, because a lot of these are very verbose in relatively good ways, but it takes a lot of tokens and a lot of context to actually generate with this. So we've tried to avoid using it in full, if that makes sense. But yeah, this is basically where I started generating, effectively just vibe coding. Okay, go, you know, build a button section, go build a lozenge section, go build the token section. Here's the file. And a lot of that was just hallucinated originally, until I could go in, or me or another engineer or Lewis could go in and be like, hey, these are all the wrong media queries, let's say. Let's go and fill in with the right media queries. And it's like, oh, okay, look at this file instead. Don't just use industry trained things. And then we get all the right things. Lewis probably used some things like this to basically be like, can we have, you know, a Figma Make or Replit version of this? And then, oh, Tailwind doesn't work. We're hallucinating more on icons than we were before. So let's over-index on certain things. And then I think there were also some cases where it's like, we don't need all of these props, or we don't even need the hide component. It probably knows how to do that. So this is like everything. Whereas I think Replit and Figma Make, we probably show only 20 or 30 components as opposed to like the 100 plus we have. Sure. So not only is it specifically our content, but it's also a very drilled down version of our content.
For a timeline for you, Rid, as well, like this LLMs.tt was the first created file. Then that's what I tried to use when I then vibe coded when Carlo was away for a month, then had to vibe code my own thing. And then once Carlo came back, we then figured out how to make a scalable version.
Okay, so we saw the guideline file. We've talked about some of the lessons learned, even about giving people coded lines of text that they can just like paste into prompts. Were there other areas or clear points where you just iterated? You did something different. You learned something about how this process should work where you made a change, or that's just influenced the way that you thought about what it would take to enable AI prototyping at scale.
We were getting pretty good results, like maybe 60, 70% from like what we call a one shot. So I was like benchmarking the effectiveness of these AI prototyping tools. And I was kind of screenshotting a simple card, and then I'd screenshot a really complex screen, and I would see how well it performed from a single shot or like a single prompt saying, like, build this screenshot and then see what the results were. And we were getting,
and is this just based off of just on the guideline file and that's it?
Just off the instructions. Yeah.
Okay.
Just off the instructions. It was getting like 50, 60% accuracy. Like with the hybrid template approach, it was, you know, getting a lot higher. It was hallucinating otherwise. But I was still getting annoyed by certain parts of it. And that was like things like our text and our icons. And I was just obsessed with trying to just get it higher and higher. And I had a little bit of an inspiration from like printer sheets. So like, you know, when you like print and you need to configure your printer, it prints like this special sheet of all these like colors and shapes and patterns. And then it's used to then configure the heads of the printer or something. So I was like, what if I just did that for AI prototyping? What if I just put a bunch of things on a prototype and just said, describe it to me? How would you describe this? How would you actually prompt this? And then use that to then reinforce the instructions to basically talk to it how it expects to be talked to. And that really helped with kind of like understanding why the icons were being hallucinated. And then also things like text. Like why it couldn't figure out certain aspects of text. And I found that it was kind of hard to determine the font size of something when I asked it to kind of be like, oh, here's a bunch of text. Tell me the font sizes, tell me the font weight. It would often hallucinate that from just a screenshot. I found that, yeah, like with these sticker sheets, that it thought differently than what I thought like. So then it was very much around like, okay, how do we actually like meet in the middle and improve those outputs? And we actually got way better kind of our primitive layer, essentially, like our typography components, like heading and text, that started to be rendering a lot more accurately. Because when it was seeing a screenshot, I was talking to it in the way that it actually read that. I'm kind of like talking to the computer vision element of it, when before I was very much just like, oh, this is Atlassian, deal with it. So I find that if you really try and go closer to the metal, then you're probably going to get better results and understanding why.
Is there an example that we can use just to get specific about it? Because I'm nodding along because like conceptually it makes total sense, but I'm also like, okay, but like where and what is that change that would allow you to kind of close that gap?
You can see the prompt here, which is like, I want to calibrate your computer vision model. Like, can you add the image in and then create bounding boxes? So this is very much like me just trying to get it to tell me about these elements and what it picks up. Because what I'm suspecting is a lot of things around like certain components that have like a weak border or things with more white space, it was really struggling to pick up the bounding box of them. and then recreate them. So this really told me a lot about like the limitations of the computer vision. And what I found as well is like the more complex the screenshot, the less it picked up, and actually it truncated and missed a bunch of elements. So, you know, like things lower down on the side navigation of a screenshot as an example. So let's say this is our side navigation, things around this prompt box or anything were just being completely skipped because it probably has reached its context limit of like how much it can ingest. And that really told me a story around, oh, okay, like, first of all, I have to now instruct our thousands of people prototyping that, okay, when you're uploading a really complex screenshot, it's going to miss stuff. So break things down into like sections of like the top nav, side nav. So it really helped me improve the, you know, the training I gave people, but also it showed me like, you know, as you can see here, the bounding boxes that it's created around it and how it interprets certain elements. So I got it to like name things as well. So you can see with this one, we have a component called icon tile. I was really interested to see how it picked up these smaller tiles with these kind of subtler imagery, which we have a lot in our products. My suspicion was it's not picking it up, and that's why it was hallucinating it. And it was true. So you can see with these, this size, it didn't pick up the color at all. It just picked up the icon. So I was like, okay, I need to provide more specific instructions to improve the outputs of this, or help users go, okay, if you have something that's being hallucinated with an icon tile, which is this component, you're probably going to have to use maybe Figma's MCP, or you're going to have to upload a smaller screenshot or like a zoomed in screenshot of it and update it piecemeal, because if you're uploading a big screenshot, it's just going to miss that. So this didn't necessarily always influence our instructions of our, you know, our design system instructions that would then generate the code. It very much also influenced how I actually talk about how to get the best results from that kind of one shot with, you know, the thousands of people using prototyping.
Hey, really quickly, let me tell you about the all new Dive Talent Network. I've hand assembled over 100 of the most talented designers and builders that I know so I can recommend them to my favorite companies. So if you're listening to this and you're open to new opportunities, the Talent Network is anonymous and super low pressure. I mean, it's just an easy way to see what's out there without having to post on social media. So if you're interested in joining, or maybe you're looking for your next hire, head to dive.club/talent. I mean, gosh, you're dealing with a heck of an adoption problem, I would imagine, and a lot of education required to get people comfortable and out of their comfort zones and whatever tools they were familiar with before. So what have been some of the tactics that you've had the most success with, and maybe any key learnings along the way in terms of how do we set people who are not as technical up for success with AI prototyping?
Our first problem is getting people to even see any training you've done. So we've got, you know, hundreds of designers, hundreds of PMs, hundreds of thousands of engineers, and we've probably got around like 11,000 employees. So there's thousands of people that are going to be using AI prototyping at one time. It's almost impossible to even reach that many people. Even if I DM'd 100 people a day, right? It's every time it's going to take amount of time. So that is the kind of starting point in your brain. It's like not everyone is going to see this thing. And I've done a lot of training, like adoption training, design system training before. And I found that like, if you build it, they do not come. You really have to make sure it's as simple as possible. And also in the different formats that people learn in. So the first approach we did was like, okay, looms, let's focus on looms, let's focus on video guidance, but then also written guidance. We found that really effective in just providing a baseline of 101 prototyping essentials, right? Like, here's just the basic stuff that you need to know to succeed. And a lot of that covered is like, one of the videos I recorded was just a UI tour, just a 3-minute UI tour of this button does this, this button does this, this button does this. Because a lot of what you'll find is a lot of people aren't that exploratory, right? They've maybe got a top-down push to, you know, you need to use AI prototyping, AI. Maybe they've got a bit of pressure. They may not have time to click every button and understand what it means. And I found it was really effective just to tell them, this does this, this does this, this does this. That's important. That's not important. Don't worry about that. That created a really nice baseline for people. And then you start like building up the confidence and the knowledge in more advanced topics. But the 101 was really around like, you know, here's the UI. Here's this new thing you have to learn. And here's just some tips on how to get the best results. So like that thing I mentioned before around, like, you know, if you want to recreate a screenshot, which is like one of the most common use cases, right? Like, I don't have this thing in Figma. It's too hard for me to constantly recreate it in Figma. I just want to upload a screenshot and then start from there so I can iterate or add a text box or whatever. Then it was providing guidance on, okay, you know, it's going to hallucinate or it's going to get things wrong unless you do things in this kind of way. And it was just, you know, really providing that guidance. In terms of distributing that guidance, we've had a few ways. We've tried to be creative as possible. We had like a dedicated AI builders week, which, you know, we've talked about publicly, which was, you know, our president, Anu, just basically said, everyone, thousands of people, tools down for an entire week, and you're all just going to learn AI prototyping. And it really created a lot of aha moments for people where they were then given that space. And we had training, we had, you know, guest interviews, we had masterclasses. I did like a 500-person Replit masterclass across two GOs, which was incredibly stressful, but incredibly valuable because we went through step by step, you know, this is, you know, let's build something together. And it gave those moments for people that are like, ah, okay, I can't do this in Figma. This is too hard. If I'm creating a filtering experience, I can't build these interactions in. But in Replit, in Figma Make, I can do it in 5 minutes. I can just instruct it, like, build this filtering sequence, and it will literally work and feel real. So we kind of made sure we had a lot of space for those moments. Now we're in a phase where it's all about, we've got a 101, we've got a 201, we've got a lot of guidance. How do we get that to the people that need to use it? You know, maybe inactive users or people that haven't seen the course material before. What we actually did is we created a Slack bot. So I created it in Replit. Well, first I created it in Cursor in like 15 minutes, and then I created one in Replit where it's got kind of a WYSIWYG dashboard. And we have an AI enablement bot. And what I found is if you add a bunch of people to a Slack channel, they're probably going to ignore it at our scale. You know, you've got Slack fatigue. If you DM people, they will respond to you pretty quickly, and they will almost like feel like they have to respond to you. So I was like, how can I replicate that at scale? Right? Like if I put people in a channel, I do an at channel or an at here in whatever communications tool, most people are going to ignore it. So what I created was a Slack bot that creates a group DM. So our design ops leads can then be the key recipient. They can add in maybe 400 people that they want to reach out. Maybe they're inactive users or they haven't used it recently. And it will group DM from the Slack bot to that person. With a kind of a canned message of like, oh, hey, you know, hey, first name, we've noticed that, you know, you've been an inactive user. Can you fill in this survey and let us know? And we got a lot of engagement from people around like, oh, I didn't realize this was a thing, or like, oh, I'm so sorry, I've been busy, X, Y, Z. And it gave us a lot of really good feedback on why people aren't using the thing or what the gaps are without having to like DM hundreds of people constantly. So that was a real unlock for us on how to enable at scale.
Are there other challenges or things that you're thinking about in terms of just maintaining this system and how everything works, especially as your product surface area continues to expand?
One of the other things that we've had a lot of success with was... that I've seen from the engineering side is a lot of design leaders are going out and sharing prototypes. So a lot of this is like coming in our design reviews top down in like, you know, weekly Loom sort of thing. Like, oh, here's a prototype I built in this new tool, new technology, or here's an idea for how we could do this with Rovo. So seeing that from, you know, your skip lead or your, you know, your leader in your design space, I think that's kind of promoted a lot of virality where it's like, oh, my boss is doing this, or my boss's boss is doing this. Maybe I should do this as well. And then it's like the good demos in our sort of design reviews appear to be the prototypes. So it's like, oh, hey, if you come in with just a static design, you know, it might be a great design, everything. But if you come in with a prototype, like people will actually get a little bit excited and a lot more commentary on the looms. That's what I'm seeing from afar. So I think that's really helped stir this thing as well, is like, it's not just flashy. Oh, we could use it. Here's some learnings, but also people hit the ground running and just started using it on a daily basis, both high level leadership as well as like, you know, low level ICs. So. Yeah, that's been
cool. I've noticed that too. Like there's a buzz when you share something that is fully functional. It's cooler. There's like a novelty factor still that draws people in.
Yeah. In terms of like maintainability, how do we maintain this thing today? So I'll I'll show you a little bit behind the scenes on what these templates actually have. So this is, Replay has a lot of boilerplate. So we've kind of put our stuff into this boilerplate. So these documentation files are ours. Like this is the guidelines file that Lewis showed. We have slightly different ones for Figma Make and for Replit. So we kind of split out the examples.md and the guidelines.md because they get indexed a little bit separately with Replit from their guidance. We kind of let them guide us on, hey, how should we serve you this 2000 line file? I get mostly into the template here, but yeah, a lot of it is just let us define the exact base of the template. So if I go into our actual front end monorepo, like this is good code. That's the baseline is you're starting with good code. You're starting with relatively production code. This might even be better than sort of a brand new POC of an application that someone might spin up. So we'll say this is, you know, front end blessed stuff for the most part. There is, of course, little bits in here that may not be super blessed as we're trying to get it working in this environment because we don't have like GraphQL and the whole teamwork graph and stuff behind it. So there's some mocks and other things like, you know, the way we do theming and routing a little bit is not 100% perfect, but I'll go into Cursor here, which is what I use, and show you how we maintain it. We have this thing, just, you know, a folder for AI tooling that sits within the rest of our design system. So we have a lot of design system packages. We kind of house all of these templates within the code. So they are actually like production code, or at least they pass most of the linting and type checking, apparently aside from that one, in our code base. And this kind of helps us maintain it so that if we actually change like our theming, for example, this will break. And if we want to update our theming and, you know, it's no longer the refreshed version of our topography theme, people will update this and then we can actually go and deploy that to Replit. So things don't break over time. So a lot of it's just literally use the design system. Now, some of this we're going to be transferring into our CSS and JS library shortly. But for the most part, we kind of break this down into, yeah, a lot of different components, like a lot of different apps. Currently, most of these, as Lewis showed, are just basic sort of, this is how to use the template. We might be building these up more so Trello is actually like a proper clone of the template, as opposed to, you know, just a hello world page. And then we bake in all of our, like, our feature flags. So we have a bunch of feature flags, which basically control functionality that effectively is required to be turned on in order to have an Atlassian-like experience to some extent. Not that many, but like our new logos, some of our visual refresh stuff, our topography stuff. We take all of this and effectively we bundle it up and we do a distribution. So these guideline files are generated actually from a very large amount of other content. So these guidelines files, for example, if I go into the avatar here, everything in our avatar package here that we have defined is actually automated and maintained from within our code base. So instead of going through and if we want to document something, document it in five different places, which is what happened, we went and we're like, okay, Atlassian.design, atlaskit.atlassian.com, lmstxt, mcp, now let's add it to prototyping. All five of those places were like different content. And at least two or three of those places were vibe coded content. So it's like, okay, how can we make it so this actually represents what we tell to our customers on Atlassian Design? Make sure these are actually our usage guidelines. I think we are in a state of making them better. I don't think they're in perfect parity. We're working through this in the next half, but our approach so far has been some sort of structured content. So we're not going down like the full data XML sort of approach, but we are going with something a little bit simpler that we think we could use to maintain, I guess, the couple thousand packages that live within our monorepo. A lot of these are just strings or even markdown files in some cases. And we basically define what our component is, how to import that. So with this, we grab all the types. With this, we actually kind of give it enough context so that the LM ideally understands what an avatar component is in its own language, like it's a profile photo or a representation of a user. We give a description, we have examples. We even have examples that are purely for AI in this case, rather than all of our internal examples, which are a little bit less clean. We have ones that are just like, this is what I want AI to build with. Very simple, clean, not all the 4,000 different cases we have for this component, but just basically the three relatively basic versions, because we realized if you give it all of those different types, it will hallucinate more and more and more and think, well, I can do this mixed with this, right? And then the answer is no, you really can't. So we try and describe, I guess, the 80% mark for most of these components. The same goes with our content and usage guidelines. This is not everything we care about on this component, but it is probably 80% of usages, which is kind of our target in prototyping, to be honest, is the 80% mark. We take all of that, these offerings JSON files, and bundle it up and just distribute it. So we have a bunch of sort of code gen and scripts basically to crawl the entire monorepo and grab a very large amount of files. So we'll just run sort of the distribute command. And then what this does is it distributes effectively a template for Figma Make and Replit. So we have a fast and full version of our templates. We have a couple others, but they're not really hooked up right now. So if I go in here, everything that you would see in here, all of the examples, we generate this from the avatar component. All the guidelines, we generate that from that avatar component. All of these apps, we generate that directly from our monorepo. And what we do is we just copy all of these files. We're looking for a way to sync them a little bit more directly to maintain them even better. But yeah, the goal has really just been about like, how can we automate the content the AI needs? Because we've had very poor success with just asking AI to go to Atlassian.design and read our components or index them. We're expecting that it knows what our lozenge or our avatar means, especially whenever we get into the nitty gritty of all of those type interfaces or our usage guidelines, or especially when we're talking about like translating from Tailwind, whenever it just hallucinates and it can't understand that, oh, this image should be an avatar. The best way we can change that is just going in and be like, well, let's handle this edge case and let's fix it.
Zooming out for a second, how long have you two been in design systems roles? And how big of a departure has the last 8 months been from what you're typically used to? Because it feels like you're almost inventing an entirely new sub-discipline within what it means to run design systems at a large company.
I've been here for the past 3.5 years on the Atlassian design system. In the past, I've had much smaller design systems, but definitely nothing to this scale. So I would say AI is really a step change for us. So for example, I presented at Config, I think in 2024, around how we do adoption, basically across all of Atlassian. How do we roll out our visual changes, our new navigation, our, you know, dark mode, that sort of stuff. And with AI, it's changed a lot where it's like, okay, how would I do adoption with AI? It is absolutely night and day. With AI, it's a lot more about like, okay, how do we document this so that it's available in the AI and the LLM's memory at all times? As opposed to typically with the design system, the way I see that we would do these things is through programs and people and cultural reinforcement, design reviews, that sort of stuff. Now it's like, okay, can we just tell it exactly what we care about? Can we tell it exactly what it needs to do? Let's kind of cut out all the fluff and just give it the bare minimum. And then the other side is like, okay, it primarily knows, let's say, Shadcn, Lucid, Radix, whatever it's trained on. How can we make our components more closely aligned with that? Like, why do we call it a lozenge component if the industry doesn't have a lozenge component? Or why do we call our prop appearance versus variant, or things like that is kind of where we're getting into, where it's like, can we just shift our system to be more, I guess, general, for lack of a better word, like the rest of the industry?
I was an adoption person, just like with Carlo. Carlo and I worked together on adoption. I've been with Atlassian 3.5 years now. I was kind of the Figma plugin guy, then the Figma guy, and then I was the kind of design adoption guy. And I really saw AI as a adoption story, just like Carlo, in terms of like, it's a threat to adoption. Essentially, it's like I saw all these things being generated that weren't using the Atlassian design system. And I actually wasn't an early adopter of AI. I was probably actually quite behind on a lot of stuff. And now I'm like lead design technologist on the AI pillar, because my passion and my drive was from an adoption lens. Like, how do I enable product managers, product designers, content designers to generate Atlassian experiences with the design system. That's always been my mission. Before, it was very much like, how do I increase adoption in Figma and how do I increase confidence that then translates into code? This is now just the next step for me. And now, obviously, I am a lot more involved in the overall AI. But it's, for me, at the beginning, it was very much that that just like design system adoption lens and increasing that fidelity. Interestingly enough, I was actually initially asked to be a tool lead for Figma Make as we were kind of upskilling Figma Make. And then it massively scope spiraled into like me essentially being responsible for the design system integration for the entire organization with Kylo to enable these thousands of people to do AI prototyping. So it's crazy how things can just in the space of 8 months just completely shift your entire mindset, where I went from being a lead designer working on adoption to a lead design technologist leading up an AI pillar with this like massive scope of work in such a short space of time. So I'm very grateful for it. But sometimes I look back and I'm like, oh, wow, 6 months ago, we were just doing that. Like, that's crazy how mature you can get so quickly.
Well, I mean, 6 months is an eternity in today's day and age with how fast things are accelerating. So I guess before I let you go, I want to use that as a launching point to maybe look ahead into the next 6 months and beyond, because you two are thinking about this a lot and you're seeing where the bottlenecks exist. I'm sure probably asking these questions, oh man, what if we could do this? Maybe this would unlock a different set of workflows over here. Like, when you kind of just look into the future, what are some of the things that are rattling around in your mind that you get excited about?
We're trying to look at like, what does an AI native design system look like? We don't know the answer necessarily, but it's very much important to look ahead. Like, what does the future look like 3, 5, whatever years? And my opinion is it doesn't look that too different to today. Because it's just the AIs are going to get better. The tools are going to be more kind of holistic. I'm of the opinion, like, what can we actually do today to bring the future forward? And, you know, what agents can we create? What tooling can we spin up? Like, what context can we create to leverage that? And also, you know, how can we make our own team kind of AI native? So the future is actually really interesting, because it's kind of, you look ahead of where you need to be, but there's actually just so much you can do today to get you there. But it's probably going to be like duct taped together, or like there's going to be an agent that just like does one thing really well. And then you have to like switch to another agent that does one thing really well. And that's maybe like today's model. What I feel like is going to be in the future, it's going to be this end to end, where maybe it's just one agent, one tool that will just kind of like handle the entire software delivery lifecycle. I don't know what tool that would be. I don't know if it would be a third party or people build it as a first party. Who knows how powerful AI can be in 3 to 5 years? I can imagine incredibly powerful, or the tools that people create are incredibly powerful. But I'm very excited for the way it's going, where I feel like teams are going to be able to, or organizations are going to be able to truly create velocity for the way that they want to write, create, and deliver to customers. When at the moment, we're in kind of a fixed mindset or a fixed tool set where, you know, traditionally the software delivery lifecycle was, you know, very much you have requirements, they get translated into design. It's usually Figma or another design tool. And then an engineer then has to read the design and then build that. Now we're kind of going into a fluid model where anyone with any tool can essentially ship to a customer. And we need to figure out how to support that. Like, the design system remit has just blown up into like anyone in the organization can essentially ship. And that's a really challenging problem to solve. And I think we need to build more tooling, more linting, everything to actually tackle that new kind of persona. Because I feel like design system is the kind of core of an AI native organization, or a truly high velocity organization.
The way I see it, as Lewis said, is the remit of a design system is blowing up. And I don't think this is new for other companies. A lot of companies' design systems are front-end platform teams, and they are the entire front-end platform, and they own the front-end platform, and they happen to have a design system within that, or they ship design stuff. For us, a lot of it is, how do I enable a designer to ship to a Jira customer? And that's a very scary thing, scary question for a lot of people. But also at the same time, we've got a couple designers that have shipped to production in possibly smaller apps. I can't think of an explicit one in Jira, but we're going in that direction. But the further we go in that direction, even the further we go with prototyping, people are no longer asking about how do I work with the design system. The design system is almost like, check, we've done that. We do that in 6 months. I wouldn't say it's perfect. We can maintain it better. We can fill in a bunch of the gaps. You know, there were bugs in the stuff we showed you. But for the most part, it's good enough to sell that idea. But prototyping, for us, I think it will not stop at just showing an idea. Ideally, it will go all the way, you know, further along that. Like, oh, can we take that idea, put it into a pull request? Can we take that idea, can we put it into Design Canvas? Can we take that idea, put it to production? I think the context that's required for that, for an LLM to know how to build within Atlassian, what's inside my head and hundreds and thousands of other engineers' head in order to actually land that is a little bit scary. So the way I look at it, just some raw numbers, is like the Atlassian design system is like 75 packages in a front-end monorepo, which is not the entirety of Atlassian front-end, which has about 5 to 10,000 packages. So if you want to build within Jira, you not only need to have the context, so the LLM needs to have the context of our 75 packages, but also the 5,000 packages, all the different libraries, the tools, the engineering, the content accessibility standards, all of those that are expected of you when you're working in Jira. So we have a long road ahead of us, I guess, to go outside of just this 1% box that is the design system. I know the design system is the largest 1% box. It probably makes up 50% of sort of the React code that you might see in Jira. But for the most part, that it's that other 50% that will be very, very hard that we have to go and document, I guess, those second layer systems or even the third layer systems. How to write tests, how to use, you know, our version of CSS and JS, how to do all those technical things, because an engineer can vibe code and say, oh no, you should use compiled instead. Oh no, you should use this internationalization library. It's specific to Jira. But a designer has no clue of that. Even myself as an engineer, I don't know how to work in Jira. So I think that's where we're going in a lot of ways. That's how we'll get to the end vision that I think we all have, which is, can we empower anybody to at least open a pull request and get peer review on that, customer review on that, and, you know, experiment that into production. I think that's kind of, you know, the 5-year goal.
Well, you've taken a heck of a first step here. Really impressed by everything that you all have shared. Definitely changed the way that I'm thinking about the role that design systems play. And I'm just appreciative that you guys came on here and pulled back the curtain. And I'm sure that you have inspired a lot of teams out there. So we appreciate you taking the time today. Before I let you go, I want to take just 1 minute to run you through my favorite products, because I'm constantly asked what's in my stack. Framer is how I build websites. Genway is how I do research. Granola is how I take notes during crit. Jitter is how I animate my designs. Lovable is how I build my ideas in code. Mobin is how I find design inspiration. Paper is how I design like a creative. And Raycast is my shortcut every step of the way. Now, I've hand-selected these companies so that I can do these episodes full-time. So by far, the number one way to support the show is to check them out. You can find the full list at dive.club/partners.